Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Are the Jazz any better than last year? Can the Suns make a big jump? Is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander a number one guy? The only question left is, say it with me, you win.
Hey, sports fans, Coach Nick here. What is up? It is the Coach Nick's NBA Breakdown Show on the Locker Room app. We're only doing Locker Room today, no YouTube simulcast, so this should go off much more smoothly than it did last time. So thank everybody for coming in here and getting ready to chop it up. I really encourage you to request to come in as a speaker. Let's chop it up and talk a little bit about what's happening in the NBA. And I hopefully will be able to give you some insight if I had got my eyeballs on what we're talking about. You know, we've done some interesting stuff over the last week over on B-Ball Breakdown as far as videos go, which is where I've been, you know, kind of keeping my eyeballs. I do want to say that I finally turned on the Jazz last night for my first extended look at how they looked this year. And man, that was pretty, pretty ugly. And I know Jazz fans wanted to shrug and say, well, it's been up and down. Some games look like world beaters and other games they don't. But they certainly didn't do that last night. It was as ugly as could be, and they got just absolutely annihilated by the Nets. What makes it worse is that the Nets didn't really, you know, Kevin Durant is in isolation or quarantining for, you know, COVID. And he had, Steve Nash put a really kind of interesting, crazy lineup around Kyrie Irving without a lot of the starters. And I'm not exactly sure what he was going for there, maybe give him some extra run, see what he's got. Well, he's got a lot, if that's what the result was, because they, from the get-go, just dismantled them, ended up winning by 34 points by the end, but it was ugly really quickly. So it was really just concerning to me just because, I mean, here's the thing. We know what the Jazz are. It's basically the same team as it was last year that got, you know, knocked out in seven games in the first round. We kind of know what they are. They're obviously better than what we saw last night, but man, it's a really bad showing when you get to that point where I wonder if that was what happened. They saw the starting lineup and figured, oh, well, we'll just easily win this because they're not sending, you know, the big guns out. But that could be what happened. But, you know, here's the starters the Nets threw out there alongside Kyrie. So Jared Allen, who I think deserves to start anyway. I think he's much better than DeAndre Jordan. He's much more active. I think he makes plays better. I just think he's a better fit in the starting lineup for him. So they have Kyrie, they have Bruce Brown, Torian Prince, and Jeff Green. So, interesting. Now, off the bench, they brought in Joe Harris, who was a normal starter. DeAndre Jordan, who was a normal starter. You know, they were missing, obviously, Kevin Durant. So, you know, it was one of those games where just from the beginning. Now, you know, we've seen, you know, I've already lost most of my Jazz fans, you know, as part of my base because of my Rudy Gobert analysis in the past. So I suppose I can speak freely about the Jazz now without being worried about people railing against me, perhaps. But I don't know. I got to tell you, you know, Rudy Gobert has been an issue for them in the playoffs, obviously, because they can play him off the court just because he just can't play perimeter and switch well enough against good teams. You know, maybe for the first round of the playoffs, he's serviceable enough where they can get by. But once you get past that, now, again, the whole thing I've been talking about with the Jazz has always been, well, maybe Jazz fans are happy with, you know, winning, you know, 45 to 50 games every year, being a tough out in the playoffs in the first round or maybe the second round if they get, you know, hot. But I don't know. I tend to judge these things on, you know, the crucible of whether or not they can play in the championship, in the NBA finals. So they paid Rudy Gobert a ton of money, and it's kind of like a used car or maybe a new car, right? The second you drive off that lot, the value goes down. And, you know, I've pointed out the issues he's had with his hands a lot, you know, and how he doesn't, you know, handle the ball well. And he's gotten better without question. So I don't want to, you know, diminish the work he's done to get better. But, you know, it's it's an issue. The hands are still an issue, all right? He still gets stripped. He still, you know, will miss shots close to the basket when the ball is not quite, you know, in his hand firmly. But it's the other side that kind of bothers me. Now, I'm going to admit I don't watch every Jazz game, okay? I don't know if anybody besides Jazz fans do that. I have to watch the whole NBA. But whenever I've checked in to watch, it's a pretty consistent thing where I end up seeing him not nearly as effective on defense as everybody wants to make him out to be. Last night was a case in point where I was just sending clips to, you know, internally to some people I know versus railing on Twitter about it. But like play after play, Rudy Gobert is getting scored on in the post, right around the rim, not being effective around there. And you start to wonder, I know that he's been up there as far as the player tracking stats show defense around the rim. I kind of have to be a little bit dubious about all of those things because I really want to see the actual clips to find out how they're ascertaining these things. But the bottom line is I can see countless plays of guys going to the basket strong against Rudy and scoring over him and around him. And it's really, really frustrating because he's the guy who's supposed to be this guy who gets all these blocks. Now, he might block a couple of those shots in a game, but how many is he giving up? And how much are they paying him to do that? It's really frustrating because it's the sense that he's holding them back to some degree.
And you might be feeling like you're being held back in your business in the same way, as you've outgrown QuickBooks and need more analysis than your outdated spreadsheets can provide. NetSuite can solve all your problems by eliminating wasteful spending on multiple systems and platforms, as it will give you all the visibility and control over your financials, HR, inventory, e-commerce, and more. Everything you need all in one place, instantaneously. It would be like an NBA team having me do a breakdown of each and every one of their games, finished immediately when the final buzzer sounded. Join the over 24,000 companies using NetSuite by Oracle and let the world's number one cloud business system work for you. NetSuite can show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/coachnick. So visit netsuite.com/coachnick and schedule that tour so you can find more success in your business using NetSuite.
I've got a very special guest because first we're going to talk about what we want to do on Sunday, which is bring in Dave King, who covers the Suns for SB Nation and a longtime friend of the Breakdown. We're going to bring him in right now to discuss a little bit about what the Suns are doing because it's been a nice welcome surprise. Maybe not a surprise to everybody, but certainly a nice little start to the season. So, Dave, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm glad it worked out this time.
Oh, you probably sound better than I do, so that's great. And glad to have you here.
All right. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, I've followed you for years, Nick. So thanks for getting me in here.
My pleasure. And, you know, I apologize if I ever took too long to respond to emails. But I'm glad that we could chop it up and we have in the past and kept me abreast of what's going on with the Suns. So let's chop this thing up. Let's figure this out. So we had a little bit of a setback in the last game. But overall, what's your grade on how the Suns are playing so far?
Wow, shoot. Let's see. So my grade based on expectations has to be an A. I was worried that they would have a slow start to the year for various reasons, not knowing each other very well and stuff like that. The Suns have almost all of their rotation from the bubble back when they went 8-0, but the point guard changed, obviously, from Ricky Rubio to Chris Paul. And I thought that might take a little while to gel, but they are playing great. They did have a bad first half against the Clippers, but they almost came back and won that game. Mm-hmm. And that was after being on a tough road trip. And Monty Williams said he was worried they would come out a little flat in the first half, which they did. So I'm pretty proud of the way they look. Will they get better during the year? I think so, actually, you know, barring any injury issues. The Suns have a big year ahead of them, I think.
Well, let's go back a step to go forward, which would be that, you know, it kind of feels to me watching Devin Booker that he's not playing well at all, no. You know, as far as shooting goes and the turnovers. And so, you know, I went back and checked because Agreed. I was like, this isn't the normal thing for him. And he's like, I think his turnover percentage is twice as high as it normally would be in the past. And I did a montage because I got the video prepped. I'm going to probably do it. Had Steph not gone supernova, I would have probably released the video a couple days ago. But I did a little montage of their turnovers, and they're ugly, man. I don't know. And so, like, what is he saying? What is the team saying about this? And, you know, I have faith that it will go back to what normally he's used to, but what's going on here?
Yeah, Devin's real quiet about this stuff. He doesn't talk about when you ask him questions about it. He's like, look, I just want us to win the game. I'm just figuring things out. Don't worry about it. You know, he doesn't actually give you a whole lot of insight into struggles he's having. To me, it's just him trying to find his place. Chris Paul is an alpha dog, right? He's like, he sucks all of the attention on offense to himself in a good way because he's a point guard. So Devin's trying to find it, you know, where his niche is on this team. And the last couple of games, Devin's been a lot better. The very last game against the Clippers, he had 8 assists to 2 turnovers. So he just was figuring it out. But their plays are a little bit different. Their actions a little bit different. The spacing and where guys are, they're going more for three-pointers this year than they had in the past. It's just a little bit different, and he'll get locked in. He'll cut those turnovers right back down. He had a stretch to start off 2 or 3 years ago where he had a ton of turnovers to start the year. And then after about 2 weeks, he went down to back to his normal self. So I think that's going to happen again.
That's all reasonable. And then as a result, if he plays better, then I would expect them to, you know, the games be easier for them as well. And I think what we were talking about as far as gelling with CP3 and Booker, it just feels like Booker needs to become much more of that very traditional two guard, the Klay Thompson kind of role, you know, and I think that would really help him to cut down on the turnovers anyway, but just get him in what he's really much better at, which is like coming off of pin downs, handoffs, spot ups where Chris Paul can create an advantage and kick it to him. As it is now, I checked Synergy, which is pretty accurate on this kind of thing for pick and roll ball handler. And right now, Devin Booker is using 35.2% of the Suns' pick and rolls, and Chris Paul is at 32.8%. And I would hope that going forward, that would at least flip where Chris Paul is doing more of them. And then I would just like to see Booker cut that down even more, probably, and let Chris Paul be the point guard that he is.
Yeah, I'm only going to – look, you know a lot more than I do about basketball. So, but I've been watching Devin Booker for 5 years every game. And I tell you what, he is not just Klay Thompson, because he can actually handle the ball real well and pass incredibly well. He actually led the league last year or the year before in assistable passes. I think it's the high-value passes. Per pass, like the value of the pass per total passes. He is a real payoff guy, kind of like Rajon Rondo had a rep for years, in terms of every pass could lead to a shot. He doesn't make just willy-nilly passes. However, you're right that Chris Paul obviously is a much better point guard, and that those numbers should flip. But I think Devin Booker is still going to be the combo guard. He's going to run point when Chris Paul is resting, and he's still going to have his 5, 6, 6.5 assists a game this year.
So let's talk a little bit about what I would perceive as his jump shot. I haven't really gone completely frame by frame through his jump shot to really figure out why, over the course of his career, he's never been even sort of average from the three-point line. Is it really just worth pointing out the shot selection over those years when maybe the teams weren't very good that's held him back? Or is there something else that you know that you've been observing?
Yeah, that's really interesting. We're all shaking our heads over this, because the guy has obviously – he won the three-point contest 3 years ago. He came in second. He came in third in 2 other years. And yet in games, even wide-open ones, he somehow finds ways to clank them. I don't know if it's mental. I really don't. We're all shaking our heads, because everywhere else on the court, he's money on his jumper. And maybe it's just in his head. Maybe he's told himself, I got to make this, and he gets in his own head, whereas every other shot – he's not so worried about it. We're all stumped.
Wow. I mean, I will throw this out there, having studied shooting for so long, that I suspect the answer is the rhythm, is when he's bending his knees in concert with when his arms are lifting up into the shot. I don't see a lot of the trainers and coaches focus on that specific detail. And whenever I've done that and worked with guys, they look at me like I'm, you know, like a magician, because they're like, wait, what'd you just do? I said, well, I'm unlocking the natural rhythm that you are just wanting. You know, like the times when you see Steph look at the other bench, he knows the ball is in before it goes in. Yeah. You know, it's the body senses that rhythm. Well, we could create that and teach the body what you're yearning for on those special shots, and you get a lot more often. So I would hope, but again, it's been enough time, and you're right, especially the open ones where, you know, you would think over time he would get better at those. But if he can't get better with Chris Paul throwing dimes to him, then I don't know what he can do. Because that the one thing that Chris Paul does amazingly is it's on target and it's on time, you know, much more consistently than almost every point guard you'll see in the league.
Yeah, one thing that's weird is the 2017-18 season, talking about three-pointers, he made 38% on the highest volume he's ever taken, like over seven a game. And that was with nobody else in the starting line, in the lineup with him that could draw attention. And since then, he's been at 32%, 35%, and now this year in a small sample size, 34%. I don't know. You're right. It's got to be about his balance and his just his actions behind that line is totally different than the rest. He's not I don't know. But I think if he had a few minutes with you, he might do better off.
Well, we'll see. Never know. Now, let's talk about defense real quick, because that was the other piece of the puzzle I was doing for this video. I tried to focus on, you know, a little bit of the defense, corner threes, and then the Devin Booker turnovers. Now, the defense, when you start looking at it from my point of view and you're breaking into it, I'm like, okay, let's go look at the point, the pick and roll defense, because that's what they're going to face the most, right? And there's clearly a pattern here when you look at all the non scores possessions in pick and roll. And I'm not going to put you on the spot. I'll tell you what I see, and then you can help me fill in the blanks. It's basically Mikal Bridges on the ball and just disrupting everything. And it's really been a revelation. I suspect he's been doing this. I know he's got the long arms and he focuses on defense. I don't remember him being so effective in the years past. Is that the case?
Oh, Mikal has been really effective since he was a rookie, actually. It's just that more and more his coach is leaning on him more and more to do all this, and he's taking the guys who are handling the ball more. Yeah, the other half of that pick and roll defense there, Nick, Coach Nick, is DeAndre Ayton. The two of them, you get the two of them in a pick and roll, defending a pick and roll, and I just saw somebody share 0.7 points per possession they're allowing as a tandem. So we're going to see some like double picks, and we're going to see a lot of attempts by the other teams not to put Ayton and Bridges in the pick and roll defense, just to switch out, like get them out of there. And so it's Devin Booker in that action or something like that. It's going to be fun to watch, but Mikal, he's been pretty good. He's getting better every year at doing this. His arms are so long, Inspector Gadget here. That it's fun to watch him. And the more he knows the league, the easier it is for him to do these things.
There's clearly a comfortability there that's going on that he's making him really effective. And again, Ayton as well has also been a revelation. I had seen stuff from his rookie year where it was like, this ain't happening here defensively.
Yeah. He's even shaking his head over his rookie year. He did a nice long thing with Mike Schmitz with ESPN. And he was just like, oh, man, I don't know what I was thinking there.
Yeah. You know, so he's gotten better. It's great to see, you know, and for a guy who is like, what, maybe 22 and looks like he's 35. Yeah. So he's aged quicker in the league than we thought. The other thing that's interesting is because you'd think what's going to happen, and you mentioned it already, is, you know, it's weird how in the regular season the adjustments don't happen so quickly as they might in the playoffs, but they're going to simply not run the – well, first of all, you'd say, okay, don't run the pick and roll with whoever Mikal Bridges is guarding. But they're purposely putting him on the one guy that the team wants to have in that action, their best player, right? So you would think that they're going to be able to screen that and force a switch. But here's the problem. They could try that, but, you know, they certainly can't do it if it's Chris Paul, because Chris Paul is another bulldog out there who's going to cause problems on the defensive end. So they have some interesting options here on defense to disrupt all of that. But I would suspect that was going to happen. And you're right. They'll probably get Booker's man to screen first and get that switch and then go into something.
But even Booker is busting his butt on defense now, because he's not the entire offense anymore.
Right.
He's kicking butt on defense, and especially when he's on ball. Where you can get Booker in trouble is when he's off ball and he starts ball watching across the court, and then his guy slips behind him. But when he's on ball defense, he's actually pretty good. Obviously not Mikal Bridges or Chris Paul good, but he's definitely you know, respectable.
For sure. Well, okay, let's wrap this thing up in a nice bow. They're 5-2, a nice start. They're in the West, which is going to be brutal, but it's also this weird scheduling where they end up playing teams twice in a row and a baseball-like schedule almost. So so what do you think here? What do you think they're going to end up with as a record, and maybe how far do you think they're going to go in the playoffs?
Well, I'm still trying to figure out that math of on a 72 game schedule instead of 82. But I think they're going to be in the high 40s actually on wins this year out of 72 games, and I really think they're going to be fighting for home court advantage by the time fans are allowed back in the stands, hopefully, for playoff time this summer. So that's my thought. I don't see anything to take me away from that other than, knock on wood, injuries.
We're okay. Fair enough. I think we're seeing, without fans in the stadiums, that the home court advantage means very little at this point. So that'll be a really radical change if it does happen. And I'm not so optimistic about any of this stuff that we're talking about as far as COVID. But it does feel like maybe by May, right, they can do something. Although, correct me if I'm
Crossing
wrong,
fingers.
I'm seeing stands in fans in some of the stadiums already, right?
Some, yes, but Phoenix for sure has said nobody is coming. We're a really infected state here right now. So nobody, no fans in Phoenix, but definitely hopefully if things break right, then we'll be in better shape by May, June.
For sure. Well, I'm going to keep my eyes off this. I'm going to definitely get the video out. Let's find out what happens tonight against Toronto. It should be a nice little test for them, and then I'm going to get this video out. But I can't thank you enough, Dave, for coming on here and helping me break this stuff down.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Invite me anytime. Thanks.
And then tell everybody where they can find you.
On Twitter, I'm Dave King NBA, and also I write for brightsideofthesun.com, and I'm on a weekly podcast called The Sun Solar Panel. You can find me all
Perfect.
those places.
Love you. All right. Thanks, Dave. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
All right. So that was awesome. I've been waiting to have him come on for a few days now. Glad we can get that all sorted out and get locker room app on his iPhone fixed. And so that was a great conversation. Love it. And so we'll make sure to be doing this on these shows as much as possible. I love to be able to chop it up, especially because, I love the fact that a guy who's been following teams so closely for that long can tell me that, yeah, in Devin Booker's third year, this happened. The context is much more rich when you can have somebody who's that's so familiar with the team. So awesome stuff. And yeah, I can't wait to get the video out. I got a lot of it prepped on Sunday. And then, of course, Steph, went absolutely ballistic. And I have to do that video, which, by the way, we could talk about that. Why not? And please, if you're on there listening, jump on. I want to hear your take on Steph thing. What was interesting was that the Harden kind of bubbled up on Twitter a little bit in the wake of Steph going for 62 and breaking, his career high, which is also higher than Harden's career high of like 61, which, listen, once you're getting over 50 something, I think it's all amazing. And that you don't need to parse, 1 point or 2 points here. But I did find it interesting. It did seem like there was some backlash, like, oh, big deal what Steph did. Harden has done 50 points 10 times his career, 20, whatever it is. With less talent around him or whatever they're trying to say. And it's interesting. It's right. I'm always fascinated by the human nature part of this and how the reactions evolve out of a good thing happens to one guy, but that somehow has to, shit on someone on another team. But meanwhile, the title of the video, I was, a slight troll, even though I did call out attention to the fact that I wrote that he was the most skilled NBA player in the NBA. And when you're talking about skill, it's a very subjective analysis here. Like, how do we really rate, who's a better ball handler? I mean, Kyrie can do this kind of inside out move and Steph goes behind the back more. There's no way to really rate that. And I certainly think that what Steve Kerr said, which I mentioned in the video, was, some of these guys like Giannis and LeBron are just so physically dominant that they actually don't need to rely as much on skill. That is a fact, all right? I'm not going to say that LeBron does not have skill. He does have skills. In fact, his passing skills are, unparalleled. But he doesn't need to do all those things because he is so much more powerful and get to where he needs to go easier than Steph, who needs to rely on, subtlety and change of pace and ball handling manipulation and shot fake manipulation. And by the way, just being able to shoot from 40 feet away. That's an incredible skill, and he does that better than anybody else. So, of course, there's Kyrie, And of course, there's Dame, and those are the two that came up, especially because we're talking about that position and that kind of body type, I suppose, because, you know, Harden could also be in that discussion. Harden is as skilled as anybody, but he is also so physically overpowering that when he goes to the basket, guys just go flying and he can finish, and he takes his chances on whether it's going to be an offensive foul or whether or not they're not going to call the foul for him by, you know, when he initiates contact. But overall, it works out pretty darn well for him. So, but, you know, pound for pound, I don't know if that's the right phrase to use for this. It's like, yeah, Steph has to be, okay, fine. If he's not the most skilled, call him the second. Okay, fine. Call him the third. You want to put Dame in front of him? I don't think you can, because I feel like with Steph's shooting, his shooting is better than Dame's. You know, we have the math for that. So that's not hard to ascertain. But my wife is texting me for the login for our Spectrum. Well, I'll try and get back to her in a little bit. Anyhow, this is the fun of having an app trying to do a show on your phone. So that's the thing I'm thinking with Steph. So if you're out there and you want to discuss this or give me some insight into what you think about why that has to be a thing where, you know, if we have to praise Steph, but, oh, that means we have to, you know, knock, you know, Harden. I guess I understand it to some degree. It also happens with LeBron and, like, Michael Jordan. And anything LeBron does, or we talk about Michael Jordan, has to be, you know, knocking somebody else. It's kind of frustrating because it's all good. Yeah, these guys are all good. And they all should be celebrated in their own way. I did want to talk about the we didn't finish the Gobert discussion, so we can kind of talk about that in the Jazz a little bit, because so they came in, they got hammered, and, you know, schedule loss, I don't know. But the bottom line is they took the Nets way too lightly, I suppose. But, man, they couldn't score. And you have Rudy Gobert out there. And I started to talk about that, where what was frustrating the most to me is, like, the things that they're paying him for, that he has the most, you know, renown. And by the way, I'm sure he's a great teammate. I'm sure he works really hard. I'm sure he's a coach's dream to have on the team. But I'm talking about effectiveness. And I'm going to tell you, I just keep seeing too often, you know, him getting scored on in front at the rim. And if that's really what he's there for and why he's supposed to be so good, then maybe that's not really the case. And as a result, it's going to be a reason why they're not going to get past the first round, for instance. Now, the other players are fine. I don't think the offense is doing them a lot of favors, like generating easier makeable shots. You know, we have the Mike Conley issue. He's okay at this point in his career, but he's not. I don't think he's the guy that's going to get them, you know, to the next level either. But again, there is a culture with the Jazz and a kind of player they like and the way they respect the game and those kind of things. And certainly Conley and Gobert and Donovan Mitchell, they all, you know, Ingles, they all, you know, are part of that. Jordan Clarkson. So, you know, there's something to be said for just sort of building that and having that together. But the bottom line for me is it's like, you know, Rudy Gobert, you could pay somebody half as much and get 85% of that production. Easy. And that's what the business of basketball is. And so, you know, I know they wanted to reward him, but they probably ultimately made a mistake with that deal, because they're going to be saddled with that for a number of years. And they're not going to get past where they are now, which is, again, could very well be their goal. That could be fine for them. But that's going to cause issues, I'm sure, in friction with Donovan Mitchell, who wants to probably win. They all want to win, but he might realize that, you know, with the way this roster is constructed, there's not a lot of leeway to do moves, and he might want to get out of there. Now, Donovan Mitchell might not be the man either. You know, he's a bit of an undersized sort of shooting guard who has struggled with shot selection and being able to sort of, you know, shoot at a higher percentage. But at his best, you know, he is great when he's running high pick and rolls. We saw that in the playoffs where they unlock some things. But Conley kind of gets in the way of that to some degree. So I think that there's a whole lot of, you know, structural issues that Jazz need to deal with, unfortunately, if they want to take another step. But, we have someone who wants to come in. Dustin, here we go. Let's chop it up. Dustin, what's going on, my man?
Yo, what's going on, Coach Nick? How are you doing?
Oh, I'm pretty good. You know, it's all things considered. How are you doing?
I'm good. I just want to let you know I'm a big fan of your content. I've got a chance to watch some of your breakdowns, and I really enjoy them every time I see them.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. I wanted to ask you this. You know, you said, you know, Donovan Mitchell is such a, you know, confusing player for me. You know, you said that he, you know, you feel like things really opened up for him when he's running that high pick and roll with Gobert, right? Why does Conley get in the way of that? Isn't Conley like a good spot up 3-point shooter? Doesn't he space the floor pretty well?
Yes. So here's my memory of what I was going through from last year's playoffs, which was, you know, the way my mind works, it was like, what, 5 years ago? It probably was only, a couple months. It's so long ago, it seems. But my memory was that, you know, there are times when Conley starts to run the pick and roll and wants to be on the ball. And you're like, no, this is not where this is not what they do well, right? You should be spotting up more. But you're right, he does spot up, and I believe his percentages were really good. So I just feel like there are too many moments where Conley feels like, well, I am this role. I need to have the ball too, don't I? And you know, in the playoffs, it was like, you got to limit the possessions where you're not as good as your optimal options. And to me, it was like, Mitchell should be controlling those possessions almost all the time. So I'm not even sure if I remember that right, if it was the Gobert pick and rolls or if it was like anybody else with the pairing. But either way, you know what I'm saying? I think Mitchell needed the ball. So I was confusing when I said that, but I hope that made some more sense.
Yeah, interesting. So that's just really interesting. So, you know, I don't think I've ever heard that argument that Mike Conley kind of gets in the way of, you know, Donovan Mitchell doing his thing. I feel like, you know, out of all players or out of, you know, I can't, you know, think of Mike Conley as a guy who just can't, you know, let Mitchell do his thing at this point in his career. He seems like a true professional. What do you think the answer is for the Jazz then? I mean, are you going to try to turn Donovan Mitchell into like a full-time guy on ball? Like right now it's early in the season, and I know that they didn't have like a super long playoff run, but they did go to the second round. And I wonder if you know, his struggles continue this year with his off the dribble shooting, because that's what really needs to take a step forward if he wants to earn that extra $30 million on his contract extension. Yeah.
Another great point too. You know, I don't know. I guess I might have to defer and say I want to see even like some more footage now and see how that plays out with his current roster. I suppose. You know, limiting him on ball a little bit more, making him more of a traditional two guard could do something to unlock him and maybe his efficiency. But I guess it's just something about the Mike Conley pairing. You know, it has my spidey sense tingling. It just wasn't a problem. You know, it wasn't working for me. Now, of course, Conley shoots the right-handed floaters, which in the past is always I start out on a weird note with him because it's frustrating when he does that. And he actually did one last night that I was like, oh, I want him to hit my head. He might have gotten fouled on it, whatever. But I just feel like that is the pairing that's not working for me overall, chemistry-wise. You know, it just seems too inconsistent. So I don't know. But you're right, because Mitchell is on the hook as well for all that money, too. Is he going to be worth it? And also the problem is, I don't think I ever realized this for some reason. He's 6'1", Donovan Mitchell. He's undersized. Like, you know, defensively, that's a tough one, especially if you have Conley alongside him, too. So that also becomes an issue when they have to get in the deep end in the playoffs. Just, you know, you need to be able to defend and be long. And I don't know if that's the if they have an answer for that either. Even though their defense has been great, right, over the past several years, I do feel like their defensive rating goes up and it does become more of an issue in the playoffs.
It is so weird to me that, you know, like, not that long ago, we were watching, like, Jamal Murray and Donovan Mitchell, like, duel it out, like, on a nightly basis, like, you know, putting up, like, just gaudy numbers. And then, you know, it's regular season, and it's just like, damn, like, you know, what happened? Like, they don't really seem to be able to, like, dominate the game like they showed they could in the playoffs. So I'm just wondering, like, you know, what do you think the reason for that is? You know, both of these, like, young guards are, you know, coming off like really great playoff performances, and now we're seeing that they're, you know, struggling a bit.
You know, a lot of things. Certainly this whole season is weird, right? They didn't have a training camp. They didn't have all the usual chemistry building things they would have had beforehand. So I'm not surprised about anything happening in this season, right? It's just going to be weird for 20, 25 games until everyone gets settled. So, you know, and by the way, any criticism tends to be unwarranted probably too for that reason. So, you know, we all get a little excited about it, and I'm talking off the handle too. But in theory, yes, we probably should all just give them the 20 games to like have their that version of their training camp through in the regular season, and then we'll see what they're at. But, you know, there's evidence, and so we can note it and then wait and see after 20 what happens.
Yeah, for sure. I think you're about to bring somebody else up. So I'll step to the side. and let you do that. I do have another question for you whenever you get ready. So.
Oh yeah, yeah. Come back in. I appreciate it. This is great. I'll bring you back in as soon as we're done with Nick. All right, here we go. Nick, let's bring you on. What's going on, my man?
Hey, Coach Nick, how are you?
Us Knicks need to stay together. There's not a lot of us out there.
Yeah, right. just want to say I really like your insight. Big fan.
Thanks.
I wanted to talk about the Nuggets, and I guess related to Jamal Murray, but I think in the offseason they lost like way too much defense. Jeremy Grant was a really big piece, and Miles Plumlee. So I think they're going to have trouble contending this year, and I just think that if they made those signings, they would be in a great position to win.
You know, the Jeremy Grant signing to Detroit was always weird anyway, but he was going to be gone, right? I think they weren't going to pay him what he wanted and what he deserved. But I think he was really integral because he was a guy that was defending at a really high level, was shooting the three, could put the ball on the ground. He's just a tough player. So that's a huge hole for sure. But then again, I thought, okay, plug Michael Porter right in there and they won't miss much. And if you look at the numbers so far, right, in the games, you know, Michael Porter has played four of the games and he's averaging almost 20 a game. Right. So that's that, you know, and he's shooting really 42% from three. So he's kind of doing, at least in the offensive end, what they would have gotten from Grant, or if not more. But you're right. There's something off with the team. Right. It's not exactly easy to put my finger on it because, you know, it's still early. We haven't quite gotten enough games. But, you know, that is a big one. Now, Jamichael Green was supposed to be another big addition for them, and he's doing nicely, too. So there's on paper, there seems to be something going on that's positive. And I have faith in Mike Malone that he can kind of figure this, some stuff out and figure out what's happening and why. But I don't know. I mean, do you have any other specific ideas of what's going on with, you know, with Murray or Jokic? It's not getting him enough victories.
I think Jokic is the most valuable player in the league. Like just his impact. He's just all over the place. I mean, obviously his defense is not the greatest. His athleticism is, I mean, it's improved, but it's still not like elite. I just think they would have to lean on Jamal Murray too much, like to reproduce what he was doing in the playoffs. And I just don't think that's reliable enough.
Oh, I agree on that. That's going to wear him out to no end. He's shooting under 40%. Oh, sorry. He's actually shooting really well this year. I misread the column. But there's no question that the Nuggets would want to rely on the talent, overall talent, to create separation early on where he doesn't have to do everything like he had to do in the playoffs. But it's also a weird schedule, right? Like they lost to the Kings twice, you know, in the first seven games. Like, you know, they're playing these guys twice in a row. And that's just weird, I think. And everyone has adjustments to make. But I can't believe that Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic is not going to win them 60% of their games, you know, and be in the top four of the West. It just seems I'm not willing to say that's not going to happen this year. So I just think it might just be a blip. There's a couple of weird teams, right, that aren't doing well yet. And it's strange because I agree. I think Jokic is, you know, he could definitely be, you know, in the top four MVP votes, you know, in that top four or five. And he's certainly the best passer probably in the league. And he looks like he might even lead the league this year in assists for the first time, I think, ever for a center by per game assists. So I'm not worried. I just feel like they're going to figure it out and they're going to get back where they were. But where they were isn't the NBA title winning team, right? I think that's the one thing that they're missing that they're not going to get beyond from last year.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I just think that, like, Millsap is really a hole in that team. I think he's really regressed. I mean, I haven't watched a lot of him, but it just from what I've seen, and as well as Gary Harris, those pieces, I feel like if those guys perform to what they were supposed to be, they would be easily like a contender.
Yeah, and by the way, a contender, I mean, we could put them in that category, for sure. But yeah, there's something, they're not quite there, and there was that question, you know, the Jeremy Grant thing was such an X factor for them, alongside Michael Porter Jr., who, you know, defensively isn't going to be nearly as good as Grant yet. And so that's an issue that they're going to have to solve. But then again, Michael Porter Jr. does have a higher ceiling overall, so this could be a little bit of a long-term thing where, you know, they're building towards next year, you know, then all of a sudden Michael Porter Jr. could be an all-star, and then Jamal Murray could be maybe an all-star. Nikola Jokic, you know, they might have three of those guys, and then they're right there.
Yeah, they're definitely building for the future.
Yep, for sure. Well, we'll keep our eye on Denver, but appreciate it. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, Coach Nick.
All right. Cool. And now, I don't know if anyone else's phone is blowing up, but everyone is texting me all sorts of swear words right now. I don't know what's happening with the Electoral College votes, but I'll flip onto that once we're done with this show. But Dustin wants to come back on, and let's chop it up some more. So, Dustin, what else you got for me?
Hey, Coach. So, how much have you seen from Shai Gilgeous-Alexander this year?
Not a ton. The Thunder, you know, they're not incentivized to win so much, and so, you know, I haven't really flipped it on. I've seen a couple of random clips of like him, but what am I missing so far?
Well, you know, I think the narrative that was being pushed in the off season was that, you know, hey, you know, SGA is going to be on ball full time. You know, the coaches are saying we want the ball in his hands, and you know, a lot of people were saying, you know, SGA is the early favorite for most improved player. And I'm a Thunder fan. Like, that's my team. That's who I watch every chance I get. And I don't think SGA is as good as people think he is. That's just, you know, my honest, objective viewpoint on SGA. If Murray and Mitchell are what they are right now, and we're not sure if they're the guy, right? Like, I think SGA is probably, like, I would put SGA probably like a tier below them as players right now. Wow. I don't think he's like a consistent enough shooter, and I don't think he offers like a ton of defensive value. Like, even though he's like long and he's got a great frame and everything, he just doesn't seem to use it that well, and I feel like he's always out of position. He's still young. He's in his third year in the NBA this year. But I just wonder, you know, if it's going to ever come together for him from a scoring standpoint. You know, he did seem to improve last year, but, you know, he was playing next to, you know, Chris Paul, Dennis Schroeder, two guys who are, you know, really savvy guards with the ball in their hands and you know, allowed Shai to play off ball. And so that brings me to the next question is, you know, do you think Shai can be an actual lead guard in the NBA, you know, long term? Or, you know, do you see him kind of falling back into like a two-guard role where he's like more off-ball but maybe has a little bit of creation ability?
Wow. Well, here's what I think about Shai. So I've always been impressed with his finishing ability at the rim and the subtlety and the how shifty he can be getting to the basket and the creativity of finishing. Now the field goal percentages at the rim might not exactly bear that out, that he's amazing at it, but there's certainly enough evidence to show that that will progress and he'll become really good at that. So I like that part of his game for sure. The three-point shooting, he's got a funky release with a lot of airspace away from his head.
He's got a hitch.
And which is part of the hitch and the two-motion shot, which to me indicates that he'll never really be a consistent three-point shooter. He was actually a little bit below average last year, but he's only taken a couple and a half a game. So it wasn't like where he is now, where he's taking six and he's below 30. That seems to be where he's going to be mired. Now, I don't know how easily fixable that kind of thing is. You know, at that point, third year in the league, you're talking about major mechanical changes, which is doable and isn't necessarily the thing that he should look away from, because how much worse could it get? You know, it's already pretty, you know, suboptimal. But that will be an issue because, you know, if you got a guy at his size who does so well going to the basket but can't really shoot that well, then they'll just sag off of him. And on occasion, he'll be able to use that runway to get going fast enough and score. But as we see with guys like Giannis, it becomes an issue, too, where they can simply just limit him, his ability and his effectiveness. But I do like his passing, and I do like the way he plays within himself to the point where you know, like Donovan Mitchell is the guy who like really just wants to score. But Shai is another guy who's more balanced, it feels like to me. And I tend to like those kind of players better anyway. The guys, they're maybe a little bit more dangerous because that pass could come and you're not sure. And so now you got to deal with two different things when they're attacking. So I think that he could be, you know, Does he have that ferocity, that alpha dog, that ferociousness that you'd need from a number one player on a great team? Like, probably not, you know, but could he be the second guy on a really good team? Like, yeah. And I think, you know, for him, it's probably the notion of you put him alongside a couple of real, you know, bulldog defenders, and he'll sort of feed off of that. I kind of want to go back and look when he's playing. I believe he's playing alongside Patrick Beverley in LA that first year, if I'm not mistaken. I kind of want to look back at some of that stuff and see if that was rubbing off on him as well in real time. But yeah. I do feel like he could get that. He could tap into that if the right people around him are there trying to push it.
Yeah. So I'll say this. You know, in regards to, you know, the first year he spent in the league, which was with the Clippers, his defense was better. But his scoring wasn't there. And then, you know, second year, his scoring was there, but his defense wasn't there. And then this year, I feel like his defense isn't there, but he's, like, continuing to, like, progress somewhat, you know, with scoring. I'm a little bit lower on his playmaking than you are his passing. Like, I don't think, like, he's, like, a great passer or anything. I think he's a guy who can make, like, simple reads.
Yeah, and, well,
maybe that's all you need, you know, but I think, like, you know, he has to either, you know, become like a really consistent shooter, or he has to become like this, like, phenomenal playmaker in order to be a first option and a lead guard. I happen to think of Shea's, like, best role as, like, I think his high end outcome is that second option. But I think, like, I think practically and you know, just speaking from a probable standpoint, I think he's more of a third option.
Okay. You know, I mean, I won't argue with that. I could see that as well. Yeah, we'll see. Those kind of guys that come in so young, sometimes it's hard to know. And then all of a sudden they take a big jump after their third or fourth year or two. They develop, you know, almost as if they'd gone through like college and now they're a man. So we'll have to see how that goes versus a guy who played 4 years in college, you know what I mean? And then three years out, we know what he is pretty much by that point. So I think that there's a lot of other questions with him, and I'm anxious to see how that goes, because I've always been impressed by him. I thought he was always, you know, more polished than I would have expected him to be at an early age, early on. And so if he's been able to achieve that at, like, during his rookie year and his second year, then there's obviously a work ethic there. There's something there and a talent that could, you know, unlock more things for him going forward. So I'm certainly anxious to find out what's going to happen with him, but I think his future is pretty bright.
Yeah. As an OKC fan, I hope you're right. I hope he does hit that second option ceiling. I just don't see a possibility to where he becomes like the first option on a team. I just think that's too much of a leap for him.
For sure.
I just wonder, you know, like, after we look back on this season, after it's all said and done, like, you know, was this too much to ask of Shea, right? To put all this responsibility on his shoulders in terms of running an offense, is it good for his development, or does it actually, like, you know, negatively impact him because he's having to, like, do too much at one time?
Right. I hear you. Well, I think in theory, it's all good, right? Even if it's rough this year, it will eventually be good for him, and he'll develop faster and out of all of this. So that's what I would imagine they're banking on. There's no incentive to win at all this year anyway, so they're going to let him just have free reign. And so so we'll see. But thank you, Dustin. I got someone else to bring on. But again, great questions. Great chopping it up with you.
Hey, thanks, Nick.
All right, talk soon. All righty. Now we got Daniel. Daniel, what's going on, my man? Daniel, you there?
Not much. I am. Yeah, I'm over here. I just wanted to jump in on this Shea debate for a second, and then I got another question. In my opinion, with Shea, this season is his first test of being that first option with no other real option better than him. Because last year he was still the first option. He led our team. He led Oklahoma in scoring, by, you know, coming off of those Stephen Adams screens and getting those mid-range jumpers or those really creative finishes. And he had a lot of room to operate, especially when he went off ball. He could get those, you know, get better looks from three, which is why he showed a better percentage, in my opinion. This year he's doing a lot more on the ball, you know. He's definitely the point guard, you know, because George Hill was in a run the offense point guard. He's just a spot up point guard who plays some defense on the other end, who is playing this season. But in my opinion, Shea can be a first option in an offense, but the offense has to be one, where it gets the ball moving, and two, where there are players that are better than him that just aren't better scorers than him. Like, Chris Paul's better, but he wasn't leading our team in scoring.
Right.
Like, Gallinari was a better shooter, but he wasn't leading the team in scoring. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I like that. Right. So the conditions need to be right for him, which, by the way, need to be right for everybody. Steph Curry, right? You know, having Clay and having Draymond and having KD, all those things. So I could definitely follow that, especially in this point of his career, because I think what you're saying is he's not the, like, he's just not a guy that's going to dominate, right? He's going to give him the ball, get out of his way, and let him go, right? That's not what's going to happen with him ever, probably, in his career. But if you get him in the right situation where, yes, and I think what you're saying about the ball movement is great, because it will loosen up the defense, create gaps, allow him to slither in there. You know, he's really hard to keep, for guys to keep in front of. You know, he twists and he turns and he starts, stops and starts. And so just a little bit of gap there can get him to the basket. So I totally see that.
Yeah, he plays really shifty. Like, he also, like, his finishes are just so slithery. Is that the, you know, it's just, he never looks like he's under pressure, like, when he's getting to the basket. So if he can get that jump shot going, especially from three-point range where he can get it off the dribble, like, he has his step back. But because he shoots it so awkwardly and he shoots, like, it's like a 10-motion shot, you know. It's right. Like, he'll shoot it, he'll take his step back, and then he'll pull it down, you know, bring it up, and then with that really big airspace between it. So if he can get that step back going, and he can get it, you know, like, Luka's got a weird step back, but it goes in. Watch, well, in this season it hasn't. It's like 15%. Right. But, like, you know, it's a threat. Shea's isn't a threat yet. But anyway, yeah.
But I think that's key. I think he has to develop that better. He needs to get back to being a 35% three-point shooter as a threat, but also as a to produce. He's going to have to produce from back there at that position, right, without question, at some point going forward. Like, maybe this year, they'll be working on it. But again, the way he's shooting it and his mechanics – without a significant change, it's not going to happen, right? I haven't seen it. It would be unprecedented to see a guy shoot that way with those mechanics and that rhythm, you know, break 30-31% on 5 or 6 threes a game.
I don't see him taking more than 3 or 4. And I think that he's definitely not a point guard. He's a two guard that will create offense.
Yeah.
I think they're testing him out there at point this season. Because they've got no other option. Like, is George Hill going to run your option? No, he's not.
Right.
So, you know, they're throwing it out there. But I think their money is on getting one of the new guys from college this year or next year or even the year up. You know, we've got time. We're going to lose for a few seasons. Anyway, my question I wanted to ask is about the Portland Trailblazers. Do you think we're overrating them? And do you think the possibility that if they don't get it done this season, that we have to start questioning Damian Lillard's production as a player who has never gone to the finals with teams that have been built around him and should, like, even maybe go as far as, like, a head coaching change? Like, Terry Stotts might not be the perfect guy. And we're also, in the last bit of this question, is do we have to look at Robert Covington as one of the most overrated players in the NBA?
Oh, wow. Well, just so you know, anybody else listening, I didn't, you know, reach out to Daniel before the show and say, hey, make sure to ask about the Blazers, because this has been on my mind. This is weird that you're asking this, because I was just talking about this with somebody else last night. You know, the problem is a roster thing, I think, most of all with Portland, but there's always fallout from that kind of thing. The roster is ill-constructed, and so, like, the coach gets fired, right, even though it might not have anything to do with him. Terry Stotts' offense has been the most clever offense generally across the board, you know, for years since he's been the head coach there. I like what they run. I think he does a great job to get those guys in good positions to score. Defensively, though, I think it's, well, the biggest issue to me, honestly, because the question can be is, can Dame and CJ really exist together in a backcourt defensively deep in the playoffs? That's probably a one big issue. But the thing that gnaws on me even more is Nurkic. So Nurkic defensively is just he's not going to get it done. It's a bad fit. He can pass well. He's tough. He can score down in the post a little bit. But he's the guy that really, I think, is making this thing untenable. So I would try and find someone else that can do, 75% of his production offensively, but who's a much better defender. I think that would really help them overall. Dame, is one of those guys who keeps his 3-point percentage down because of shot selection a lot of the time, right? And so I think he'd be a lot better if he didn't take as many shots as he does. I think that CJ ultimately is probably a better shooter, right, and better mechanically sound. And then to get to the Covington's thing, I like Covington. Is he overrated? I think isn't he kind of rated the way he should be?
I've seen him rated as a top 50 player, and that he's one of the best perimeter defenders in the league. And I used to think that with Philadelphia, but now he's bounced. He seems to be one of those players that every team wants to trade for, but then after a season or two, everyone can't wait to get rid of. He has short stints with Philadelphia after he signed his contract contract extension with Philly, then got moved. Then he signed, and then he went to Minnesota. Then got moved. Then Houston was there for, 6 months? And then he got moved.
Yeah. No, that those are all facts. And you're right. This year, I've been watching him play, and I've been like, that's interesting. Like, he got beat pretty easily on that, That's not supposed to happen, right? I mean, it's like the kind of the thing I was talking about earlier with Rudy Gobert. The things where they're not supposed to happen that happen enough times, and you have to wonder. So the list of top 50, I guess I'd have to look at it to really figure out if he should be in the top 50. But I think obviously he God bless him, he got paid. That was, he deserves whatever he can get. But I think that becomes a ticking clock for a lot of these teams when they're not getting what they need from all of that. So that is an interesting issue with him. And so I think that the whole roster is sort of malformed. You got Rodney Hood, who had done well for them earlier, but doesn't look very good right now. You got, who else do they have? I mean, Enes Kanter, he comes in, it's like, forget about it. He can maybe, if they're lucky, will just be able to score enough to offset what he gives up on defense, but that's a lucky. Usually it's a little bit.
You can't as a backup center anymore. In my opinion, with Portland, you just, as silly as this sounds, you have to kind of do what Houston did, because you can do it way better than what they did. You can get a center who's 6'9", 6'10", long, athletic, who can, shoot the ball, guard the perimeter. Like, if Derek Jones Jr. was 6'9", he'd be their best option at center. But right. He's 6'6". Like, he can't guard centers. He's just that bit too much small. So I think, you got to move Derek Jones, because he can't do anything on offense outside of dunk the ball. And he doesn't work with Nurkic at all. And then you're going to move Nurkic, you're going to move Kanter, you're going to move Derek Jones, you probably end up having to, you got to move Covington. Like, this team, if they want to go deep in the playoffs, they've got to make some real major adjustments. And in my opinion, do we have to start looking at Dame as I've been called as a person with bias against him, but in my opinion, if you're going to have a guy who can shoot the way that Damian Lillard can, eventually you got to start producing. And he's had teams built around him, not perfectly, but he's had shooting around him at least. The guys that, don't have shooting around them, in my opinion, that's why us with Westbrook, we never really won properly, especially in the 18 year. In my opinion, if we had some a decent roster, we would have gone deeper. But Dame has had a good roster around him, especially with CJ, and he's had one of the most creative coaches who figured out that drops suck if you set the screen high enough,
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen, they're going to have – I'm sure they're looking at it, even if it's internally and quietly, about breaking that Dame and CJ up and figuring out who they're going to trade or not. It would be devastating to the community. Portland loves both of those guys. And that's all, you got to be pay attention to that too, as part of it, especially for a small market team. So, the list you just ran down is the entire roster could be overhauled completely. And it's just a flawed roster completely. And they can cover up some of the warts when Dame or CJ gets hot, but that's not going to be sustainable. And, it's too bad, because these guys deserve to be on, even better teams. I think both CJ and Dame do. So, Stotts will probably be a casualty as well. So don't be surprised if Stotts you know, unfortunately, it's a long run for him. He's been there for a lot of years now. Don't be surprised if he isn't coaching after this year or in the middle of this year. And don't be surprised to see one of those, you know, don't be surprised if the rumors start coming out about Dame or CJ getting traded or it actually happens.
Heard from Twitter a few times from, like, I think it was Shams, I think, don't quote me though, that Portland has declined a trade offer from Houston that was basically built around CJ for Harden.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wait, but Portland didn't want to give up who?
Portland wasn't giving up CJ for Harden.
Wow. That's fascinating.
Like, who do you give him up for then? Like, CJ McCollum is nowhere near the offensive player of Harden. And I don't even think he's better defensively than James Harden is.
Right. No, I mean, listen, I it's hard for me to imagine Portland, you know, turning that down. but then again, they're probably looking at Harden and Dame together and thinking, that probably doesn't work.
No, yeah, no. That, if you're talking about firepower, it does, but both of them don't play well enough in the playoffs.
Right, right. That's true, too. So, well, listen, Daniel, the show is over. And I got it. You know why I have to go is because the United States is completely melting down under some sort of craziness going on at the Capitol right now. So I think we got to – I know it might not be as important to you, but maybe you're going to watch it as a like a car accident. But
laugh. No offense.
Yeah, right, right. So I'd get to that. But listen, thank you so much for coming on. I'm looking forward to the next show. You'll come back on. We'll talk some more.
No worries.
All right. Take care. All right, everybody, that was the show. Awesome stuff. Really great stuff. Thanks for Dave King to call in and talk about the Suns and everybody else coming in. Dustin, turn on your TV. And also, great idea, Nurkic for Gobert. Hey, why not? I wouldn't say no to that for the Portland side. And again, thanks, everybody, for being here. I'll be getting back again on Sunday at the same time, 11 a.m. Pacific. And until then, don't forget, sports fans, at B-Ball Breakdown, not a channel, we're a conversation. You in?